Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Jazz arose in the late 19th century North America, most likely in New Orleans, based on the musical traditions of Africans newly freed from slavery. Grounded in the music known as the blues, which expressed the pain, sufferings, and hopes of African Americans under the thumb of Jim Crow, this new music entered the world via instruments that had been abandoned by departing military bands after the Civil War. Dr. Gerald Horn's new book, Jazz and Justice, examines the economic, social, and political forces that shaped this music into a phenomenal U.S. and Black American contribution to global arts and culture. We're also going to talk with Dr. Gerald Horn about another book on South Africa that he has recently published, White Supremacy Confronted, U.S. Imperialism and Anti-Communism versus the Liberation of Southern Africa from Rhodes to Mandela. Dr. Gerald Horn joins us in the studio. He is a professor of history at the University of Houston and the author of many, many books. Dr. Horn, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
What about your book, Jazz and Justice? I mean, that's the theme of one of the most important radio stations here in Washington, D.C. It's right down the street from us, the Pacifica affiliate, WPFW. I mean, their moniker is Jazz and Justice.
And I think appropriately so, because this is a story, as your introductory remarks suggested, about the growth of this contribution to global culture, pioneered mostly by Black Americans, and how they were exploited shamelessly, not by Black Americans, but by others in this white supremacist society. In fact, I tell a story in the 1920s in St. Louis, which in some ways is emblematic of this larger story, whereby the Ku Klux Klan forces were trying to bar Black Americans from playing in nightclubs and in night spots and for audiences defined as white, whereas organized crime and the mafia got into a scuffle with the Klan because they wanted these Black musicians to play at their nightclubs and night spots. And of course, organized crime won. So the Black Americans had a choice between either fighting or aligning with the Ku Klux Klan or fighting or aligning with organized crime. And of course, they chose to align with organized crime because at least they could get a job. And then as an adjunct to that, you had these repeated efforts over the years for Black Americans to try to organize organized crime families. And what they found was that that was well nigh impossible because their competitors and mostly Italian-American organized crime, Jewish-American organized crime, et cetera, had clout within the police authorities, within the district attorney's office. And so whenever the Black Americans tried to organize an organized crime family, they'd get immediately squashed, which meant that the musicians then were subject to even more crass exploitation. And then there's the story about, say, Duke Ellington, who, of course, has roots right here in Washington, D.C., the great composer and pianist. I think it was Miles Davis, the great trumpeter, who said that every musician should get down on their knees and thank Duke Ellington for existing and creating. Now, what's interesting is that his manager, Irving Mills, put his name on some of Duke Ellington's key compositions, which means that now that both are dead, the descendants of Irving Mills are reaping the benefits of music that Duke Ellington composed, and Duke Ellington's descendants, of course, are left in the cold. These are the kinds of stories I tell in this book, Jazz and Justice.
I wanted to ask, too, jazz was so specific to the African-American community, especially in New Orleans in the beginning. How did it move so quickly around America to cities that really didn't have large African-American communities? For example, Minneapolis has always had a huge jazz scene. Kansas City has had a great jazz scene. Several of the big cities in Texas. How did that happen so quickly? Was it that white Americans realized the value of jazz and adopted it? Or was it African-American musicians moving around the country and bringing it to white America?
It's all of the above, plus the fact that there's the Mississippi River. There's one hypothesis. Of course, if you go to New Orleans, you should not call this a hypothesis. You should call it a fact that this music developed in New Orleans and then spread from the Mississippi River northward to Memphis, to St. Louis.
Which makes sense because Minneapolis is right on the Mississippi.
Exactly. That's one theory. Now, the other theory is that a sort of a candelabra theory is what I call it. That is to say that the music arose simultaneously in a number of different places, not only in New Orleans, but also in California, which, as you know, before 1942 did not have a sizable black population. But some of the first references in print to this term, J-A-Z-Z, come in San Francisco, for example. And then, of course, there's this idea that it actually grew out of Memphis and northern Mississippi, which abuts Memphis. And, of course, the blues is a hot, as said in the introduction, this music really comes out of the blues and to some extent means it comes out of northern Mississippi. So there are many, there are all these different theories, although if you go to New Orleans, unless you want to get smacked, you should not refer to hypotheses and theories. You should just say it's a fact that it developed in New Orleans.
Dr. Gerald Horn is our guest. We're talking about one of his new books. This is a book called Jazz and Justice. What's the rest of the title, Dr. Horn?
Racism and the Political Economy of the Music.
Okay, so let's talk about, and John, you were kind of getting at that, the political economy of the music. And of course, the contribution of the black community, black artists, black singers, such a profound, perhaps the most impactful element, single element of American culture comes from the black community. And of course, there is at the same time this history of extreme exploitation.
Oh, yeah.
Of extreme exploitation that doesn't stop.
No, it lasted well into the 1960s, maybe even early the early 1970s.
Or maybe till, what's today's date? June 5th, 2019.
Jay-Z just made his first $1 billion last week.
But still, while there are black artists who are clearly succeeding, mm-hmm. the exploitation of the art forms and the culture brought forth by the black community, let's talk about the political economy and the exploitation.
Well, there hangs a tale. One is the question of organized crime. If you look at these clubs where the music mostly sprouted, you'll find deep and pervasive organized crime connections. That's not only true for so-called jazz clubs. If you were to do an analysis pre-Stonewall and even perhaps even post-Stonewall of gay clubs, those were mostly dominated by organized crime as well. And then, of course, there are the record companies themselves. They are also heavily influenced by organized crime, but also by immigrant communities. There's a story about Washington, D.C. I'm trying to integrate all my Washington stories into this discussion. Ahmet Ertegun, who was of Turkish origin and, of course, was the son of a diplomat. In the 1930s at the Turkish embassy in Washington, he would have as a youth, he would organize integrated music combos to play, which, of course, was against the law. But this was Turkish soil, the embassy. And he moved from there to founding Atlantic Records and made a huge fortune. His papers, by the way, for anyone who is interested, are at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland. He made a huge fortune off of these black musicians. Matter of fact, the singer, Ruth Brown, was known as the house that Ruth Brown built, was what Atlantic Records was called. And of course, he became very close to Henry Kissinger and David Rockefeller. He entertained them on his commodious estate in Turkey, for example. And he was not alone in terms of being a non-black person who profited handsomely from the results of the labor of black Americans. Now, of course, once again, in Washington, D.C., at the Library of Congress, or the papers of the drummer Max Roach and the bassist Charles Mingus, who in the 1950s tried to start Debut Records. But once again, they ran into exploitation. I mean, they ran into racism. It was very difficult to get Debut Records off the ground. Of course, there were repeated efforts by black American musicians to start clubs, once again running into a stone wall. And so this is a story that I'm afraid to say has not been sufficiently disseminated. And to a certain extent, as your comments suggested a few moments ago, continues to this very day.
Dr. Gerald Horn is our guest. Between 1915 and 1935, jazz was, according to, I'm reading from the National Humanities Center, Teachers Serve. This is someone you may be familiar with, Gerald Early.
Oh, yeah, sure.
For nearly the first half of the 20th century, from about 1915 to 1935, jazz was the dominant form of popular dance music in the United States. Is that accurate?
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure. And it's interesting. I tell the story about how the music moves from being a dance music to a listening music, which has a lot to do with Jim Crow. It has a lot to do with the fact that, as John's comment suggested, the music has crossover appeal, as they say euphemistically in the United States. And therefore, to these clubs, you would find interracial dancing. And the authorities cracked down on that. And from out of that stew comes the listening music. And then, of course, there's the question of bebop, which is still the form of jazz that is most popular. That was a response as well to many of the Black American artists who felt that their tunes and that their style of playing was being counterfeited and stolen by non-Black musicians. So they were trying to develop a style that would be difficult to steal, difficult to counterfeit. And then that leads to this music bebop, which is, you know, unless you know what you're doing, it's not easy to play. But then that too helps the music to migrate from dancing to listening.
Dr. Gerald Horn is our guest. We're talking to Dr. Horn about his new book. How many books do you have?
In the 30s, I guess.
In the 30s. America's most prolific author, Dr. Gerald Horn, is here with us in studio. His latest book, and he has another one we're going to talk about regarding South Africa. But this book is called Jazz and Justice, Racism and the Political Economy of the Music, A Galvanizing History of How Jazz and Jazz Musicians Flourished Despite Rampant Cultural Exploitation. Let's talk about D.C. Again, WPFW, the Pacifica affiliate, has as its moniker Jazz and Justice. Now, the different Pacifica stations have their own sort of imprimatur about what does it mean to be radical public radio. In the case of the D.C. station, say, compared to WBAI, and that's where I spent most of my life, was in New York City, it wasn't Jazz and Justice. It was more eclectic. It was, you know, lots of things, a lot more talk radio, actually. Here in D.C., there's a very, very, very strong music component that still exists, and they're sort of holding on with that format. What's particular about D.C. for the theme Jazz and Justice? Why is it the dominant theme even for this Pacifica affiliate?
Well, now you're talking about the history of Washington, D.C., a city that was once known as Chocolate City, that is to say, for decades, I would say particularly since the 1950s, and I'm doing a book on Washington now, which is why I'm spending so much time in this city, particularly from 1954 in Brown versus Board of Education, the desegregation ordinance by the U.S. Supreme Court, it led to a certain kind of white flight, which increased the Black population of Washington. And then, of course, Washington, D.C. is a southern town as well. We talked about the role of the blues, which is a southern form of music, a Black southern form of music. And I think that those factors has led to Washington, D.C., of course, having a number of jazz clubs, although a number have closed in recent years, mm-hmm. but you still have a fair amount. And then Washington, D.C. Has the honor and distinction of being the home of Duke Ellington, perhaps the premier composer, premier pianist of this entire music, perhaps even of music in general.
Yeah. Dr. Gerald Horn is our guest. I'm looking, you know, if somebody just puts a search term in, say, segregated downtown Washington, D.C. department stores, you find the sit-ins at Hex Department Store mm-hmm. in the 1950s, mm-hmm. the Woodward and Lothrop Building not far from here, all of these downtown department stores in the early 1960s, even in 1963 when the March on Washington happened, and that became this iconic moment, and Dr. King talked about a post sort of racial society, people would be looked at for their character rather than the color of their skin, et cetera, et cetera. Even then in 1963, Black people were not really able to go into department stores right here in downtown Washington, D.C.
And then there was a problem as well when these Black diplomats started coming to Washington from the Caribbean and from Africa, and they were being subjected to Jim Crow. In fact, in another book I wrote some years ago, I talked about how the State Department came up with this idea that they were going to give these African diplomats and Caribbean diplomats a sort of button to wear, like members of Congress wear, so that they could go into these restaurants and department stores that Black Americans could not visit. And there was always a problem in terms of commuting of these diplomats from Washington to New York, that is to say, being turned away from restaurants in Maryland in particular, being turned away from gas stations, motels. I'm sure you followed the story of Green Book, this Oscar-winning movie. And the Green Book, of course, was this special publication that told Black Americans where they could find a toilet on the highway, where they could find a restaurant. And, of course, many of those sites, they had to – it related to Maryland, right cheek by jowl with Washington, D.C.
Yeah, indeed. I have to say I was pretty shocked. And when I was 10 years old, my family drove from Rochester, New York to wherever – I think it was Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, for a vacation. So we drove because that's, you know, people didn't fly then. You put everybody in the station wagon and you drive. And as soon as you hit Maryland, it was like the colored and white only motels, public laboratories. Now, that's north of Washington, D.C. I'm talking about north of Washington, D.C. And again, people today may not fully realize, especially younger people, just how recent this whole apartheid state was in America and here in the nation's capital. And you have this contradictory phenomena, and I would like you to talk about it. Maybe we can use this as a segue to some other international topics. Quite a contradiction where Washington, D.C. is not only the capital of the United States, but the capital in a way of the free world, or as it was characterized by the State Department and others. And yet here in Washington, D.C., or north of Washington, D.C., apartheid as the law of the land.
Well, historians such as myself have been suggesting that it was the international pressure of the Cold War, when the United States trying to charge Moscow with human rights violations while maintaining this horrendous domestic style apartheid, and at the same time trying to appeal for hearts and minds in Africa, the Caribbean, et cetera. And that creates this dynamic that leads to the Brown versus Board of Education decision in 1954 at the height of the Cold War. That is to say, the Supreme Court saying that Jim Crow, separate but equal, is unconstitutional. And then that leads to the next point, which is that with the retreat of the socialist camp in recent decades, there's been less international pressure on the United States, and perhaps there's been a reversion to the mean, as some might put it, and therefore into the mean in both senses. That is to say, the election of Donald J. Trump in November 2016, and an attempt to, quote, make America great again, which some have interpreted as make America whiter again, and bring back the bad old days, because there's this perception that there's less international pressure. Now, of course, I think that those who are being propelled by that theory might be surprised by our ability to organize and mobilize in the international community. But as the 45th president likes to say, we'll see what happens.
Some of the very leading lights and organizers and leaders of the civil rights movement, and they were also from the left, were making the argument after World War II especially that the sort of seemingly impossible political terrain in racist America made it such that Black people, in order to get justice, had to internationalize their appeal. And people were taking it in the campaign like We Charge Genocide, a campaign to the United Nations. Now, when we think about that and how that was considered to be such a primary strategy or tactic for the freedom movement in the United States, and now you compare it to what's going on since 2016, where, again, both parties are making the argument that Russia is meddling in America and sowing social discord because it supported, or Russian media supported, the Black Lives Matter movement. And in fact, perhaps the suggestion being that movements like the Black Lives Matter or any freedom movement or anti-racist movement was nothing other than a ploy by a foreign adversary. Again, it was the outside agitator. When you look at that history, I mean, we're coming full circle, tragedy, then farce, whatever, however you want to characterize it. But it's remarkable that it's made a comeback.
Well, that allows me actually to raise a point with regard to my other book, White Supremacy Confronted, U.S. Imperialism and Anti-Communism versus the Liberation of Southern Africa from Rose to Mandela, because the socialist camp plays a huge role in this particular book. I did research at the archives of the African National Congress in South Africa at Fort Hare University, which is like the Howard University of South Africa, the alma mater of Nelson Mandela, Robert Mugabe, many other African leaders. And when you go through that archives, it's apparent that but for assistance from the socialist camp, the ANC would have been up the creek, because it was the socialist camp that was arming them, that was educating the African militants, that provided the rest at their sanatoriums in Sochi on the Black Sea, for example. And a traumatizing experience for U.S. imperialism comes in the mid-1970s for the next decade, when the Cuban troops intervene on the side of the freedom fighters in Angola, southwestern Africa, and that administers a smashing defeat against the apartheid forces backed by the United States Central Intelligence Agency. And that also helps to induce the apartheid authorities to negotiate more honestly, because there was a real fear that the Cuban troops would march into Pretoria and forcibly eject them from power. And that concentrated the mind wonderfully of the racists, which made them negotiate more honestly. And Henry Kissinger himself, the U.S. Secretary of State, spoke of the Cuban intervention as being traumatizing. And therefore, they doubled down on their efforts to dismantle the entire socialist camp, so in order that these traumatizing events would not recur. And it so happens that the Berlin Wall began to crumble in November 1989. Nelson Mandela was freed in February 1990, a few weeks after that. And of course, F.W. de Klerk, the last apartheid leader, said explicitly that he was moving in that direction because he saw the ANC as being weakened along with their allies in the South African Communist Party, and that this would be a propitious moment to negotiate, because he saw the correlation of forces was shifting in favor of his ally, U.S. imperialism. And I dare say that even independent South Africa, and of course they come to independence in the first democratic elections in 1994, has been handicapped ever since, this country of 50 to 55 million, by the fact that their ally began to decompose once they assumed power.
Dr. Gerald Horn is our guest. Dr. Horn's other book, we talked about his book, Jazz and Justice, just out. A new book, also out, White Supremacy Confronted, U.S. Imperialism and Anti-Communism versus the Liberation of Southern Africa from Rhodes to Mandela. You know, I remember Kenneth Kaunda, who was the president of Zambia. This was about a decade before, about a decade before the actual end of apartheid in South Africa, or the release of Nelson Mandela, let's say, from jail in 1990. He said, well, the South African Revolution is going to make the French Revolution look like a tea party. Now, I love that quote, because I thought, yes, and I hope so. And of course, the French Revolution, you know, cleared feudalism root and branch, as it's stated. And of course, there was a lot of violence from all sides. It was a major, perhaps the most profound event in Europe for hundreds of years. And I think it would have been obvious that unless there had been some sort of negotiated settlement, that would have in fact been the case, because you have the black majority that's a real supermajority and super exploited, and it's a rich country and it's a developed country. It's a country that could actually not only free itself from apartheid, but become really the locomotive for all of Africa, or at least sub-Saharan Africa. And just the pent-up rage and anger of this majority population being subjected and sort of enslaved in their own homes. And yeah, without the collapse of the socialist bloc, it would not have ended well for not just the apartheid system, but the system, the economic substructure of that system, the capitalist system in South Africa.
A couple points. One, this book, as the title suggests, also deals with contemporaneous liberation struggles in Mozambique, in what is now called Namibia, Angola, as noted, and of course, Zimbabwe. And I tried to integrate all of these liberation struggles into one overarching narrative. And secondly, I'd be remiss if I did not mention the massive solidarity movement on this side of the Atlantic spearheaded by students who were forcing and compelling their universities to divest from their endowments that had holdings in the many U.S. corporations that were investing in cheap labor in South Africa, General Motors, Ford, the rubber companies of Akron. The list is long and endless. And then, of course, unions themselves, such as the International Longshore and Warehousemen's Union on the West Coast, which refused to unload at the docks in Long Beach and Los Angeles goods from apartheid South Africa and from colonized Southern Africa, that had a dynamic impact on the ability of the liberation forces to struggle. But there are some clouds that blur the rainbow as well. One of the points that I make in this book that has achieved some traction is the fact that the NAACP, the oldest and largest civil rights organization, which felt compelled to take the road of anti-communism in the 1950s, was working with the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency to flip the leaders of the ANC, who, of course, were in alliance with the South African Communist Party and still are, and get them to come over to the anti-communist camp. Now, of course, when Nelson Mandela came to the United States in 1990 and was lionized, a lot of that history was swept under the rug. You would have thought that the NAACP was with the ANC and Mandela every step of the way, but that does not happen to be true. And then, of course, I should also say that some of our black nationalist friends as well in 1974 were arrested en masse in Tanzania because they were trying to smuggle arms to Jonas Mvimbi, Ronald Reagan's favorite African, also a comrade of Paul Manafort, now in Rikers Island, who was a big GOP fundraiser then. And that is also a story that's told in some detail in this book.
That's really interesting. I helped organize in 1979 a sort of major anti-apartheid demonstration in New York City, in Manhattan. And the New York chapter of the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists endorsed our anti-apartheid demonstration, but the national organization would not. And they were associated, of course, with the AFL-CIO. And at that time, and the people would be surprised about this when you think back about it, because 10 years later, everybody was against apartheid, right? But even this organization, very progressive organization, wouldn't support the anti-apartheid action that supported ANC or some of the other black nationalist forces in South Africa because it was said that they were communists. And so the anti-communism, even as late as 1979, 1980, kept these organizations that just a few years later became principal actors in the anti-apartheid movement. Profoundly interesting. We have 1 minute left, Dr. Horn. What do you want to say in conclusion?
Well, since you mentioned the AFL-CIO, I tell the story about the turning point in the region, which is the Portuguese Revolution, April 1974, which ousts the fascist government, leading to decolonization of Angola and Mozambique, which then has a catalyzing impact on the liberation of Southern Africa as a whole. The AFL-CIO representatives, they land in Lisbon in May, and they're instructing the CIA as to what to do in terms of destabilizing the new government in Lisbon, telling the CIA to man up. I mean, you know, you guys, you can't let this unfold. Actually, it's a local angle because the records are all in College Park, Maryland, the University of Maryland.
Wow. Anyway, we're gonna wrap it up. Interesting, fascinating discussion. We've been talking here in studio by Dr. Gerald Horn. He is a professor of history at the University of Houston and the author of many books, including Jazz and Justice, Racism, and the Political Economy of the Music. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can also follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday from 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. metro area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and clear.